You're listening to A Climate Affair this afternoon. I hope you're having a terrific day. We have a special guest on the show. Charlie's calling from Sydney from the World Wildlife Fund. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Kate. How's it going?
Terrific. Great to have you on the show. What are you guys up to today?
We've been flat out all week, actually. We've organising this Earth Hour event in Sydney, where we're getting as many people as we can to switch their lights off for 1 hour.
1 hour? Just 1 hour? What is that going to do for us?
Well, it's more of an awareness-raising exercise. It's part of a wider strategy to reduce Sydney's greenhouse gas emissions by around 5% by the end of the year. That's the equivalent of taking about 75,000 cars off the road for a whole year.
Are you saying just turning off all of our power for an hour is going to reduce Sydney's emissions by 5%?
No. This is kickstarting that campaign. So we're still waiting to see how many people take part in Earth Hour, and then we're going to have a much better idea as to how much greenhouse gas you've actually saved in that hour. But this is part of a much wider strategy to reduce Sydney's greenhouse gas pollution by 5% by the end of the year.
Fantastic. So what kinds of response have you had to this campaign?
We've had an overwhelming response to this campaign. We've had over 1,000 big corporations have signed up to take part.
That 1,000 Sydney corporations. Is that just in Sydney or is that around the world? Around Australia?
That's mainly in Sydney.
Wow.
Yeah, we've had well over 40,000 people have joined up. We've got the Opera House switching its lights off.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, we've got the Sydney Harbour Bridge, Luna Park, Fort Denison, the Town Hall. Most of Sydney's major icons are going to be switching their lights off.
So you're going to get people out on picnic blankets with champagne and you know, nibblies and things, watching the lights go out instead of the lights go on and the fireworks.
Yeah, that's right. It's designed to be a bit of fun. There's all sorts of, you know, interesting fun events happening around the city. We've got a number of bars are serving beer by candlelight. There's yoga by candlelight. We've got restaurants, some of Sydney's key restaurants like Rockpool are taking part, and they're just going to have candlelit dinners for the
night. How are they going to cook everything? What are they going to do?
Yeah, well, I'm imagining they'll probably leave the lights on in the kitchen just for safety purposes, but the actual restaurant itself will just, they'll switch all the lights off.
It'll be very romantic. It'll be like an aphrodisiac across Sydney.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We've even got an Earth Hour wedding taking place, so they're doing their wedding by candlelight as well, which would be quite nice.
That'll be fantastic. What an exciting event. Who came up with this idea?
This is this is something we've been working on for about 10 months. It's the idea of Andy Ridley, who's our head of communications, and he got the idea after a similar event in Thailand, which wasn't a climate change event, but they did switch their lights off for 5 minutes, and they managed to save enough electricity to shut down one coal-fired power station just in 5 minutes. We're not saying that we're going to achieve that, but we'll be interested to know, you know, how much greenhouse gas we actually save in that 1 hour.
It is absolutely amazing. And is using candles better than using ordinary electricity in the future? I mean, I see that you've got a sort of a longer-term plan, not just a sort of gimmicky stunt. You're thinking, no, we really want to push Sydneysiders to reduce their general energy consumption, I'm supposing, over the rest of the year. How does that tie in to your plan?
Yeah, look, this is really just, it's a way of people making the connection between, you know, switching the lights on and climate change. It's a sort of a fun way of bringing home that message that, you know, what we do in the home and how we use electricity around the home really has a huge impact on the amount of greenhouse gas that goes into the atmosphere. You know, we want every individual to understand that electricity consumption is a direct contributor to global warming, and that, you know, small actions that we take every day can make a huge difference.
Especially when you do it in a visible way with the community like that, it becomes very powerful. You realise you're not just a single person, but you're part of an entire community, and we're not alone doing these things.
That's right. I mean, I think people are really anxious to know what they can do about this issue, and that, you know, everyone's aware of climate change and everyone I think, is concerned about, you know, the future of the planet and the direction that we're headed in. So this is just a way for people to sort of get together and take some collective action on something like that.
It's amazing. I mean, I personally tried to reduce my power bill, and I thought I was being really good by, you know, turning off the aircon whenever possible in the middle of summer. And my energy bill came back, and I thought, where's all this energy going? And so I sort of went around my house, and I found things like when a dishwasher stops its cycle, there's little lights that stay on, and I think that dishwasher drains enormous amounts of power even when you don't think it's doing anything, and all the standby lights that everyone's got their, well, you know, we've got our computers plugged in, our televisions, and so you're really not just saying lights, are you? You're saying sort of everything we're using electrically in the house, let's try and minimise it.
That's right. I mean, absolutely. Excuse me. It's, you know, it's leaving your phone charger on. It's, you know, the stereo, most people's stereos remain on standby. You know, it's making sure that the computer screen on your computer is switched off, as well as the hard drive before you leave the office. You know, it's all of those sorts of things. If you drive through Sydney late at night, as you know, is the case in most major cities, it's phenomenal how many lights are just left on.
You
know, some of these buildings are completely empty, and yet all the lights are blazing.
Is there a security concern about having the lights off? Because I know some city councils keep lights on specifically to, you know, in the parks and things to make it safer for people, and in buildings, office buildings, to sort of protect against theft and so forth.
Mm.
What is there any sort of extra precautions being taken?
Well, all public access areas will remain lit. So there is it's quite safe to be moving around the city that night. There won't be any kind of, danger zones that are going to be blacked out or anything like that. In terms of leaving, when it comes to security, I don't think you need to have the whole, you know, when you're talking about some of these big towers in the city, the skyscrapers, I don't think they need to have all their lights on for security purposes. It may be that they might have to have the foyer lights on or something like that, but you certainly don't need the whole building to be lit, I wouldn't have thought, for security reasons.
No, fair enough. So the main city lights will be on, but a lot of dramatic features in the Sydney skyline will be turned off at 7:30 p.m. on the 31st of March, which is only a couple of days away. And do you have any advice for anyone who's not in Sydney but sort of wants to participate? I mean, do you have any sort of anyone else around Australia trying to help out?
Oh, absolutely. We've got communities all around Australia taking part in this. I know that Byron Bay up on the north coast of New South Wales is a lot of people in Byron Bay will be turning their lights off in support of this. There's people in Tasmania are being urged to do the same. This is something that can happen right across the country, and you know, from small towns to big cities, you know, it's something that everyone can get involved in.
You do have any major sort of television exposure that's going to sort of have a countdown of how much less electricity Sydney's using?
Well, we do have Energy Australia is going to be measuring how much electricity is saved through that hour, and they'll be releasing those details probably on Monday. This is something that's never been done before, and we just don't know how many people are going to take part or you know, how much electricity we're going to save. So it's quite an interesting exercise in itself just to see what we can do in an hour. But these sorts of details will be released by Energy Australia probably sort of early next week, around Monday, I'd say.
Well, it's very exciting. So where can we go to find out more information about this Earth Hour and what you guys are up to?
If people can visit our website, which is www.earthhour.org, you can find out how you can get involved or how your business can get involved. And you can sort of register your details on that website, and that's a pretty easy way to do it. Otherwise, you can go to the WWF website, which is just www.wwf.org.au.
There's a lot of W's in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of W's there. And there's plenty of information there about not only Earth Hour, but about all sorts of climate change initiatives and campaigns that we're doing.
And just before we go, what's a couple of campaigns that you'd really like people to know more about?
Well, I mean, we WWF works across the board from, you know, climate change to species, threatened species work, and we do a lot of marine work. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that people can find out about if they go onto our website. For example, you know, we've got a campaign at the moment to try and save Macquarie Island, which is down in the Southern Ocean, which is being destroyed by a rabbit plague. Then we've got work up in Queensland trying to, save the Great Barrier Reef from overfishing and the impacts of climate change on coral up there.
Which is hugely important. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, so there's a lot going on, and good luck with the plan on Sunday.
Thanks for that. Hopefully it'll all go well.
It sounds like a fantastic idea, and I think it'll be very exciting to see how much energy has been saved and whether it changes people's habits forward through the year.
Yeah, that's right. Look, this really is just a fun way for people to get involved in finding a solution to climate change.
Terrific. Okay, so we've just been talking to Charlie Stevens from the World Wildlife Fund in regards to Earth Hour, which is happening in Sydney, 7:30 p.m, 31st of March. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. And it's a great opportunity to take a nice deep breath and relax and let yourself take a break from all your stresses and your worries and your concerns. Because like Earth Hour gathers a community of people together, and we can see visually together how much of a difference we make. We are not alone in anything. We are all part of each other, and we breathe the same air, and we all share this world, and we even share very similar bodies. So if you feel like you're alone, or if there's no one else who could be possibly feeling like you or could understand how you're feeling, remember, we are actually very similar to each other, and there probably is someone out there who's feeling just like you. Make an effort to talk to people and give your mum a call. I'm sure she'd like to hear from you, and I'm sure she'd give you some support. Hope you're having a fantastic afternoon. It's a climate affair. Prime Minister John Howard has ruled out adopting short-term emission reduction targets and has backed away from deep cuts by 2050 as his government moved to undermine the views of British climate change economist Nicholas Stern. Mr. Howard said many of Mr. Nicholas's policies would do great damage to the Australian economy, and he refused to endorse Labor's commitment to cut emissions 60% by 2050. He says he's not going to join the Labor Party in committing to targets that would do disproportionate damage to the Australian economy. These views are going to further isolate Australia from the global consensus after Britain has pledged to cut emissions by 60%, California by 80%, and France by 75% by 2050. It's interesting that out of those lists, one of those is an American state, California, which is something like the sixth biggest economy in the world. So California as a state of America is actually bigger than most economies as countries. China is also moving very fast, as is India. It's the first time Mr. Howard explicitly ruled out deep cuts over the longer term, putting him out of step with most corporate leaders and the Business Council of Australia. Business Council of Australia has actually supported Labor's emission reduction target, and long-term goals were crucial, and it would give time for clean technologies to be proven and made commercially available. I mean, we're talking 2050 here, not tomorrow. A poll released by the Nonpartisan Climate Institute also found that 66% of voters would support a party with a strong, clear climate change plan. Climate change has become a potent political issue, with 80% of Australians supporting laws to reduce greenhouse pollution, with targets for 2020 and 2050. Speaking at the press club in Canberra, Sir Nicholas again rubbished the Prime Minister's view that deep emission cuts would drive industry and jobs offshore. He said that the idea that the economy is suddenly going to go uncompetitive because the costs increase by 1 or 2% just doesn't hold water. Very interesting. It isn't just greenies and hippies who are worried about climate change. It includes the Business Council of Australia, and it looks like Australia's going to be left behind if we don't start adopting new technologies. The rest of the world is going to go ahead and we're not. Oh, Howard. I hope Howard wakes up and realises what's going on. Relaxingly Yours, Planet Radio 88 FM. We've been discussing the economics of climate change and the views of British climate change economist Nicholas Stern. And Johnny Howard's not listening to what he's got to say. Cutting emissions by 60% by 2050 is going to cost only 1% of gross domestic product a year, compared with 20% if no action were taken. This is based in a 700-page report called the Stern Review on the economics of climate change. 20% if no action is taken. He says strong action on climate change is perfectly consistent with growth. In periods of rapid technological change, there are often opportunities for high economic growth. Unfortunately, Mr. Howard and Treasurer Peter Costello seem to want to undermine all of these scientific views. I mean, when you've got economists and scientists and most politicians agreeing that climate change is incredibly important, it looks like these other guys are going to be on the back burner. And as I heard the other day, even Republicans in America are saying it's time to put conservation into conservative. And John Quiggin today said that those who prefer conspiracy theories to scientific evidence on global warming will find it difficult to recover the credibility they have thrown away. You're listening to A Climate Affair. The federal government will today launch a plan to tackle climate change by using targeted aid to curb global deforestation, one of the main contributors to rising greenhouse gas emissions. Prime Minister John Howard is to commit $200 million to the project, with the goal of getting other countries to tip in similar amounts to create a global fund that will invest in developing countries. The aid will be used as an incentive to scale back logging operations such as those in Indonesia's tropical forests, which have been blamed by environmentalists for exacerbating climate change. Of the 1.6 billion trees felled each year worldwide, an estimated 1 billion are not replaced. The initiative meets the calls from green groups for action on deforestation, which is said to contribute about 20% of global emissions. And the policy is consistent with the views of Nicola Stern, who we were speaking of earlier, who said that Australia could play a big part in helping countries such as Indonesia combat deforestation. However, the initiative does fall short of the economy-wide measures suggested by Stern. He said $10 billion US could reduce global deforestation by 50%, and this would be achieved at $5 a tonne of greenhouse gas abatement. This is well below the abatement costs of clean coal or renewables, which could run to $40 a tonne. So what we're looking at here is, what can the government do? There's a lot of choices when it comes to reducing the carbon footprint of the Australian economy. And of course, any of the decisions made to make that reduction are going to come at a certain cost. However, one of the interesting things is $200 million spent in Indonesia. Why are we doing it overseas and not actually doing anything about deforestation at home? But Bob Brown, the Greens leader, says it's a huge hypocrisy of the federal government. He thinks it's extraordinary that the Howard government can be putting money into the Southeast Asian problem while practicing the same broad-scale logging, burning and atmospheric pollution in southern Australia. To retort to that, the Prime Minister says that the plan actually has a greater impact on climate change than the Kyoto Protocol. He says it's going to really slow the rate of trees being cut down, and that 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from clearing the world's forest, and that's second only to emissions from burning fossil fuels to produce electricity. And it's more than all of the world's emissions from transport. But yeah, the Greens are like, yeah, great, fantastic, really good news. But why don't we start in Tasmania? We're losing enormous amounts of forest in Australia, and making a difference in just ones overseas seems rather strange. Why is it so? You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. As the public becomes ever more green conscious, the energy and coal industries are hoping that the controversial technique of storing emissions underground will clean up the image of coal. The Energy Supply Association of Australia recently commissioned research which identified the capture and storing of emissions from coal-fired power stations as the cheapest way to drastically reduce those emissions. So keep in mind, some of the options people have been thinking about for getting rid of carbon includes carbon offset programs via planting of trees. So this is a different version that the coal power stations are considering. Certainly the industry is working with power stations on ways to use coal so that greenhouse gases are not released into the atmosphere. They are really focused on carbon capture and storage technologies, and they know they can be put in suitable geological foundations where they'll stay more or less forever. And they know that it works because it's been done around various places around the world. And Australia is great because we have a very stable geological basis. So anything we bury is going to have a lot greater chance of staying put, unlike if we were in Japan or if we're in California, anywhere there's earthquakes. The biggest challenge is actually getting the cost of capturing the carbon dioxide down. And there are three different ways of achieving the capture of carbon dioxide. In an existing conventional coal-fired power station, a chemical process, post-combustion capture, can be used to strip the carbon dioxide from the exhaust gas from the power station. Another process entails using pure oxygen instead of ordinary air to burn the coal, giving a more concentrated stream of carbon dioxide, and then a physical process is used to remove the carbon dioxide. Gold gasification is a process by which, instead of burning the coal, it is reacted with oxygen and steam, producing a gas rich in hydrogen and carbon monoxide. The gas can then be used to run a gas turbine or even as a transport fuel. The gas is again reacted with steam and the carbon removed. This would be applied to new power plants. And there are a number of plans in Australia to build gold gasification plants, and there's a world first oxygen firing plant approved for Queensland. So we're at the forefront of these new techniques. It's really very interesting to see the coal industry themselves taking carbon capture very seriously and investing millions of dollars. In fact, the federal government has contributed $500 million into investigating these things, and the actual industry itself has raised $300 million through a voluntary levy on its members to fund the research and technology to organise and orchestrate carbon capture. Planet Radio 88 FM, you're listening to A Climate Affair this afternoon, and I have another interview, this time with the man in the lab coat. Are you there, man in the lab coat?
I certainly am, Kate. How are you today?
Well, fantastic, mate, fantastic. So who are you? What's going on?
Well, my name's Ben McKenzie, and I call myself the man in the lab coat. That's my on-stage persona, in which I try to educate people about science and science issues through comedy, and that's kind of my bent. I like to refer to myself as an amateur scientist because I'm not an actual qualified scientist, so I don't want to pretend to be something I'm not.
So tell us about your background. How did you get to being somewhat like a scientist but somewhat not?
Well, I did. I've always been fascinated by science ever since I was a little kid. Always been into dinosaurs, always been into astronomy. I've always been into all that kind of stuff, but not just those things, also just basic physics and chemistry, and I loved it all through high school, and eventually I did go to university, and I did try studying science at university, but unfortunately that didn't agree with me too much, probably because I chose to study computer science, and I don't really want to be a computer scientist.
Oh no, they're not real scientists anyway. There's no test tubes, there's no goo.
You never get to blow anything up except by accident, and then it's a disaster. So yeah, it's not the best.
Unless you make flubber. Unless you make flubber, flubber's good.
Oh well. Make flubber and turn it into a computer, you're doing all right.
Those are the quantum machines, yeah.
Yeah, oh, well, that's huge at the moment, the whole quantum computing movement. But no, so I'm always fascinated by it, and but performing's always been my first love, and this is kind of my way of having my cake and eating it too.
And there aren't that many science entertainment shows out there, really. I can't even think of one apart from yours.
Well, unfortunately not at the moment, and that's kind of what my new show is all about, the fact that what we do see of science in the media is very skew-if. It's not very accurate. It's not really on the money. And what we see is a distortion. The analogy I use in the show is that what you see in media and popular culture about science is pop music, but real science is rock and roll. And that's my entire theme for the show.
We need a guitar solo for that bit.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the theme of your show. So tell us some of the rock and roll science as opposed to the pop music science.
Well, you know, pop music science is stuff like basically anything that's manufactured in order to, just as a product, as commercial, to sell something. The classic example that I start off with in the show are the Sam Neill meat ads. Now, whatever the benefits or downsides to eating meat, I don't think you can really seriously claim that we were meant to eat meat because it helped us evolve our brains into the way they are today. And if you look at the science behind it, if you look at the evolutionary science, if you look at the evolutionary nutrition, it just doesn't stand up. And that's a classic example. We're going to say this is science, and really it just doesn't bear out.
So what is it? I mean, you know, a lot of people think that we did evolve somewhat as, you know, hunters, and you're saying the science doesn't back it up. What's the claim there? What's the argument?
Well, the big claim is that it was absolutely vital from cavemen, for want of a better word, through to modern human beings. And really, it would have had a part, but we've never been, you know, exclusively meat eaters. We've always been omnivores. We've had a very varied diet for a very long time. We're equally crap at eating all kinds of different crap.
And like pigs or rats.
Exactly. You know, and it's not essential. I think that's the claim that they make, is that, you know, we had to have eaten this in order to evolve into what we are now, so we must eat it now. And that's the big part of the claim that's false. We don't have to eat meat now. We can get all the proteins that you need from other sources if you've got the discipline to do it. I don't claim that it's easy. But, you know, it's a claim that you must do it. It's natural. Therefore, it's the best thing we can possibly do. It's just, it's taking it too far.
So, given that you think that the rock and roll here is what, like, the truth, I take it you think the truth is pretty cool?
I do think the truth is cool, but you know, it goes further than the truth. The whole thing about science that makes it rock and roll is that it challenges people's perceptions of the world. I mean, that's what classic rock is all about. You know, it's about sticking it to the man. And science does exactly that when, you know, you're talking about common sense and convention. That science challenges that on every turn. I mean, we think the world is flat if you just don't believe your senses because it looks flat. And it feels like it's still, but it's not. We know that it's round and that it moves, but we only know that because we've investigated it scientifically. And that's, you know, that's always been a point of contention in history. And there's plenty of other things like that where science shows you something that's totally contrary to what you would expect.
So tell me more about your show. Where are you right now, for example?
Well, right now I'm actually in the offices of Trades Hall in Melbourne, where I'm going to be performing the show. There's a whole lot of shows on here. There's a group called Comedy at Trades that are running a big group of shows. There's, I think, about 100 different artists and 40 different shows performing here throughout the Comedy Festival.
This is the Melbourne Comedy Festival
that
you're talking
about? Yeah, it's an international comedy festival. I think it's been running for a good 25 years or more, I think, now. And it's, you know, it's one of the three big comedy festivals in the whole world. So it's really exciting to be part of it. And it's really exciting to be here at Comedy at Trades because it's an independent group, and we run out of Trades Hall where, you know, people are pretty right on and they know what's going on. And the venue's great. There's lots of tiny little rooms. I'm in this tiny little room tucked away nowhere, so it's going to be a very intimate show, but a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. So you've got something to say about the Union of Concerned Scientists. Who are they?
Absolutely. Well, they're a group in the United States, and they were formed in about 1969, largely because of fears over the misuse of nuclear technology. But the thing is, these days, what their really hot-button issue is governmental interference in science. So they're really worried about the integrity of scientific research. And the big issue at the moment, of course, is climate change. And whereas we've seen a bit of a backflip here in Australia with our government, that still hasn't quite happened with the government in the United States. And there's been a lot of evidence come out that governments, not just in the States, but also here and in other countries as well, have tried to suppress the government scientists from speaking out on climate change issues where what they have to say disagrees with the government's position.
It's pretty atrocious. I mean, certainly Bush has got the policies of not giving aid to countries that promote condom use, and there's an enormous lack of funding for very important stem cell research in the States. Do you know anything about Australian science and whether the Australian government has been suppressing those type of things?
Well, it has happened. The main issue in Australia has actually been climate change. You're right to point out there's other things in the States as well, but the big one has been the CSIRO, or CSIRO, as people in the know call it.
Oh, CSIRO, yeah, totally, mate.
And I'm pretty sure, because we've shortened Melbourne Cricket Ground to the G, I'm pretty sure sooner or later CSIRO is going to be called the O.
I think the Ro.
The Ro. Well, that's pretty good too. I like that because it's a Greek letter.
I'm very street.
But they've had plenty of problems with this in the past. There's been a few times when climatologists there have come out and said, you know, we weren't allowed to talk about this or answer questions. And there was quite a bit of furor just a year or two ago with their policy on public comment, which actually says in more or less as many words that government scientists working for the CSIRO cannot comment either way on any policy that the government might have in regards to climate change. They're just not allowed to say it. So if a journalist phones them up and say, hey, you guys, you've been doing research into this, do you think, you know, we need to cut down our carbon emissions? They have to say, no comment.
It all sounds very depressing. And one of the things you do in your show is, of course, you're in a comedy festival. Explain to me how you take this terrifying, almost horror-filled scenario and inject it with humour. It seems like an enormous challenge.
Well, I think the main thing for me that makes the show work, and I think that the audience can get behind, is how you characterise it. And really, I talk about the guys at the Syro or the Row or wherever they're from. They're the rock stars, you know, they're kicking against authority, and everyone appreciates that kind of story, and you can inject a lot of humour in it when you start thinking about guys who normally, I mean, it's about challenging the perception of science. People think about it as guys with crazy hair in white coats doing weird things with test tubes and Jacob's ladders in a lab somewhere. That's not the reality, but the reality that I paint is that really they're rock stars, you know, they're out there playing their guitar solo, they're out there smashing up hotel rooms, they're basically disobeying authority because they think authority is wrong. And in a very real way, that does happen, although I tend to push it, the analogy, a little bit far, shall we say, for comedic value.
Take it to the extremes, the punk rock end of, I suppose, all, you're saying really all science is punk rock in its true form, which is a challenge to established opinion.
That's right. And look, I mean, you talk about revolutions. It's, you know, possibly heard of Thomas Kuhn, famous philosopher of science, wrote a book, you'd remember the title.
And the structure of scientific
revolutions. I mean, he basically says, you know, science normally goes along normally, but then someone will come along and just go bam and change the whole structure of the scientific landscape with a theory that breaks down the things that were there before. That's just like when, you know, the Sex Pistols or Nirvana or the Rolling Stones showed up on the rock scene. They changed everything as far as music was concerned. That happens in science as well.
What's the thing that is really exciting you in science right now?
Right now, well, there's a couple of things that really excited me. One of the things I got interested in recently is fuel cell research, which is, you know, fuel cells are a very clean form of energy. There's a lot of different
types. Are they the ones that use hydrogen?
Well, a lot of them do use hydrogen, and the ones I've been looking into are ones that do use hydrogen. They've been around for quite a long time, and the problem with them has been, like with solar cells, is that they're just not super efficient. Like, most of them sit at around 60 to 70% energy efficiency, which means they're not getting as much energy out of the reaction as you really want to make them, you know, productive. But they're getting to a point now where, and this is the exciting part, we can start using them in things. So, for example, in Japan, they're about to test, I think it's next month, for the first ever time, a train actually carrying passengers on a passenger route using fuel cell technology. Now, it's going to be backed up by big batteries as well. But, you know, it's a step forward to this whole new form of energy that we haven't really used in a commercial or industrial framework yet. And it's really exciting to see this changeover starting to occur.
And look, trains are exciting and Japan's exciting full stop anyway.
Yeah, true.
Add fuel cells to that and it becomes explosive, although hopefully not hugely explosive and, you know, death-inducing. One of the problems I've heard of hydrogen cells is the actual hydrogen. Where do we get it and how expensive it is to produce it? Mm. What do you know about that?
Well, there's a couple of different ways that you can get the hydrogen. That is exactly one of the big issues, is where you get it. You can get it out of electrolysis of water. That's a very, like, it's an easy source. We've got plenty of water.
Yeah, water's got H2O.
That's right. So you run an electric current through it with an anode and a cathode, and you can actually separate out the hydrogen and the oxygen. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's it in a nutshell. The problem with doing that is it's very expensive for the amount of hydrogen that it produces. The problem, you know, they're trying to come up with new ways of doing it, and there are a couple on the market, and the other problem with them is that a lot of the cheaper ways of producing hydrogen produce carbon and other greenhouse gases.
Yes.
It's still a big issue. So that's why at the moment, I mean, these trains are going to have battery backup, so they don't need too much hydrogen to run, but they also do need another source of electricity to, you know, charge up the batteries. So it's getting there, but you're right, that is one of the big issues.
It's huge. And you were mentioning batteries as well. I mean, one of the big problems with renewable energies in totality, whether it's wind or solar or tidal, is that they don't produce base rate electricity. So they don't produce a constant rate of electricity because, of course, the night time comes and the sun goes down, no solar, winds ebb and flow. Geothermal seems like a really good place to go for some base energy because there's a constant heat of the rocks underneath the earth. But one of the issues here, of course, is if we had better batteries that could store energy, then those renewable problems wouldn't be as bigger problems, right?
Well, that would certainly help because you can collect that energy when it's available and then use it whenever you need it. But, I mean, the problem when using batteries, of course, is what do you do with them? Batteries don't last forever, as anyone who's bought an iPod will know. And even modern batteries do contain chemicals that might potentially have problems for the environment. So you've got to make sure you know what to do with them. And older batteries are even worse. Like, they can contain things like sulfur, and of course, car batteries contain a lot of lead. So you have to take that into account. They're unfortunately not an all-in-one solution. But, you know, it's still a lot of modern batteries you can reuse for a long time. So it's not a huge issue with the newest technologies that are coming out. So it's more an issue with older batteries. The other thing is that when you do run out, you've just got to find new ways to recycle them. And there are programs for recycling batteries. There are companies now in the United States and in a few other countries where they can reclaim, I think it's about almost 90% of the useful chemicals out of the old batteries and then reuse them.
It'd probably be much more efficient. I mean, look, get inside that mobile phone and grab some of those precious minerals rather than, you know, carving tons and tons of rock out of the earth for, you know, sort of a lottery of minerals, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the thing about recycling, people have been talking in recent years about how some forms of recycling actually cause more pollution than, you know, just burning whatever it was that you were recycling. But the other thing you've got to realise, it's not,
you know, that's
about
not true
being
too
environmentally friendly. Yeah, well, first of all, it's not very true. but second of all, I mean, we only have a limited amount of all our resources. We can't just get rid of them. I mean, one of the ones that I actually occasionally, and I must admit I play it up a bit more than it really is worth, but one of the ones that worries me is helium. Helium's actually quite difficult to come by. It's unreactive. It's not like it's in chemicals and we can get it out of them. Most of the helium we have on Earth comes from pockets trapped deep underground. And once we let it out and it eventually inevitably escapes, like it does from balloons and anywhere else where we use it, that's it. We can't reclaim it at the moment because it goes right up into the very top level of the atmosphere where we can't get at it.
That's very scary, the loss of helium.
Yeah, I mean,
helium crisis.
One day we won't be able to have those balloons at parties. We won't be able to breathe it in and do the tricks like, you know, they used to do on Hey Hey It's Saturday. What are we going to do then?
We don't have Hey Hey anymore either. I've been missing Hey Hey more and more recently, and the lack of balloons is just cementing the loss of our culture. What are we going to tell our children and our grandchildren once we spoke with squeaky voices? But you'll never do it.
No, we'll have to find some sort of alternative. But that in itself is a fascinating scientific topic, why you get squeaky voice, because it's not as simple as it might sound. It's not about the temperature and it's not about the density of the gas. It's actually about another property altogether. So this is why I'm fascinated by science. You find something simple like that and you have to really delve into it to figure out how it works. I love it.
Why is science considered uncool? What is going on?
Well, I think, frankly, it is to do with the media and popular culture portrayal of science. I mean, if you think about it, on TV, how many scientists are there? There's not a lot.
Carl, Dr. Carl.
But when is Dr. Carl on TV? He should have his own TV show, but does he? No, I mean, he occasionally appears on Good Morning Australia.
But he always wears ordinary clothes, you know? Like, if there was a bit of a shaved head here or a safety pin there.
He needs a mohawk, mate. Yeah. So I'm very excited because I might get to meet him during the Comedy Festival, which would be great, but see what happens there. But the other thing, of course, is that even our fictional scientists are not very representative of the real thing. I mean, we used to have basically the only scientist on mainstream TV was the paleontologist from Friends, which was
Ross.
Ross, you know, and Ross Geller was not portrayed as a cool guy.
No, deep
and
geek, deep.
And they avoided talking about his job, whereas I think paleontology is one of the sexiest things you could possibly do. I mean, we're talking about dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs, what's not to like?
I mean, I know. I mean, come on, admit it. Dinosaurs are to 5-year-old kids what, you know, naked women are to 10-year-old, 15-year-old kids. Because, you know, you've never seen one. You're pretty sure you'd like to, but you don't know what you'd do if you were presented with one. And your bedroom is covered with pictures of them.
And they're not directly out of a figment of your imagination.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, there's a possibility that, you know, if we get our conditions right and they actually allow us to build that Jurassic Park, that we could get them. I mean, that's what we want, isn't it?
Well, I would love to. Unfortunately, one of the things I point out in my show is that the big problem with cloning dinosaurs is not that we don't have any dinosaur DNA. We might eventually get that in some way or another at one stage. But the big problem is that in order to clone something, you don't just need the DNA, you need the egg. So if you're going to clone a sheep, you need the DNA, but you also need a sheep's egg to put the DNA in.
Sheeps don't have eggs, Ben.
Well, they do have eggs.
Oh, I suppose the little eggs.
They
all
do,
right,
tiny
fine.
Little eggs, just like people do.
Yeah.
But you need that to put the DNA in, and then you need a sheep to turn the egg into a lamb for you. So that turns out the thing that we really need that we don't have to make a dinosaur...
Is a dinosaur.
Is a dinosaur. You know?
It's a deep trauma.
But they might be able to do it with mammoths, because elephants are pretty close to mammoths. I don't know if we should, but there's talk about it.
Well, there was the whole publicity stunt of bringing back the Tasmanian tiger by using, I think, it was even Tassie devils. But now the Tassie devils are on the edge of extinction as well. Do you know about that?
No.
Oh, it's really terrifying. There's got not much publicity about it, but there's been a lot of government money thrown at it. Mm. Tassie devils mysteriously dying. No one understands what's going on.
Can't lose those. I
mean, they're trying to isolate them and take them off to islands. So it's a lot of traumatic things going on in the fauna and of the world.
Sounds to me like we shouldn't worry about cloning Tasmanian tigers. We should just concentrate on breeding the Tasmanian devils.
That's right, and make sure that it's the Easter bilby, not the Easter bunny, that's supported in Australian chocolate.
Absolutely. I fully support the Easter bilby.
So do I. Well, let's take a quick break with talking to Ben McKenzie on A Climate Affair. He has a show called Scienceology down in Melbourne in the International Comedy Festival. It's going to be an outrageous rock and roll festival of science, bringing the excitement of science to the stage. You guys should all head down there if you can. And if you can't, Ben's going to come up and see us in Brisbane. We're going to go to a song. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM, where the glass of milk is always half full. We're talking to Ben McKenzie down in Melbourne. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Kate. And that would be a full glass and a half of full cream dairy milk, as one of my heroes used to say.
Full cream dairy milk from happy cows without antibiotics or bovine growth hormone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we were talking about human diets and meat before, and one of the big things is that, you know, the MLA, that's Meat and Livestock Australia, will tell you you must eat meat. The meat we're eating today is very little like the meat that we used to eat millions of years ago when we were coming down from the trees. So
really?
Oh, yeah. Back then, we mostly ate meat that came from game animals. So things like deer.
Oh, the beer beast, my favourite.
No. But deer and bison, and they run around and they're very fit. And they have a very different combination of fatty acids and proteins in them than we get in farmed cattle and sheep today. So they used to eat about twice as much protein as we do today, but they had much lower cholesterol levels than we do.
So would it be better for us to eat things like kangaroos?
I reckon, yeah. Look, I think there's a very good argument for it. They have very different makeup in terms of the proteins and, again, the fatty acids in them. And, you know, they don't get the Heart Society tick for nothing.
Ah, yes, the Heart Society kangaroo. So we could eat a lot of our noxious beasts, our horses and camels running around the desert.
Absolutely.
As well.
And of course the benefit of eating farming kangaroos is they don't ruin all of the landscape like our cattle do with their hooves.
It's another challenge. In fact, they've just released really interesting data, speaking of the difference between farmed and wild food. They've actually done some tests finally on organic fruit and vegetables.
Ah, excellent.
Because the organics movement has been claiming for decades that their fruit and veg are higher in nutrients than conventionally grown with pesticides and herbicides and things, the rest of the food. And it's sort of been difficult to figure it out. You're like, well, if it grows, it grows. You know, a tomato grows, it probably has the same stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. And the interesting result is the reason it doesn't have the same nutrients is that fruits and vegetables that have to fend for themselves against pests actually produce more antioxidants.
Ah.
And I'm going to mispronounce this, phylloxylenes. Okay, that's wrong. There's my dyslexia for you.
Phenolphthalein.
Something cool, right?
Yep.
Go to treehugger.com in order to find out the real truth about what I just said. But they have found that these things that nutritionists are saying are so important for us to get more of if we can... the organic fruit and veg seem to have a greater proportion of them, and it looks like it may be because they've had to fend for themselves and haven't had a sort of, I guess, a cosseted existence sprayed with these other substances. And, of course, the conventional crops also have residues of all the pesticides and chemicals used, in addition to having less nutrition. But what was interesting about this was it was, you know, precisely looking at nutrition without looking at the pesticide residues. So they're good, or better in all respects, really.
So there you go. It just goes to show that whatever doesn't kill your tomatoes does make them stronger.
Very.
Survival of the fittest tomatoes.
there was a movie once called Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I bet
I'm familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. Those babies, they were out in the wilds, mate.
Yep, they were ready. They were ready to kill.
So tell us more about your show, Ben. When are you running?
Well, my show's on for the whole festival. That's from April the 4th right through to April the 29th. And I'm playing every night at 6:30, except for Monday nights during that time. And I'm down here at Trades Hall, which, if you come to Melbourne, if you're not from Melbourne, is on the corner of Victoria and Lygon Streets. And the show is $12 concession or $16 full. Or if you come on a Tuesday, that's tight-ass Tuesday night, it's only $10. And that's cheap for a comedy festival show, I can tell you.
It's cheap for anything, anytime.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty good for an hour's entertainment, I think. But I can go one better, Kate, because I am going to give away some tickets to your listeners.
Wow!
All you got to do, if you want a ticket for my show in the first week, that's from April the 4th through to April, I think it's the 8th, whatever that Sunday is if you email me at ben@labcoatman.com.au and put in the secret code word for having listened to, you know, Planet Radio, which is Erasmus.
Ooh, Erasmus.
E-R-A-S-M-U-S.
He's Darwin's grandfather,
that's
isn't
right.
it?
That's right. He is Charles Darwin's grandfather, one of my favourite men. He wrote a book called Zoonomia, in which he almost came up with the idea of evolution. He was on the right path, but he didn't quite go that far. Anyway, if you email me with that word, code word, the first six people to do that will get two free tickets to the show for that week.
What a wonderful promotion, and I love the secret code word Erasmus. Erasmus Darwin. Well, though you won't penalise someone if they put Darwin in at the end, though, would you?
No.
But Erasmus, very clever.
They just need to give me their detail. Obviously, I'll have their email address, but I'll need to know their name as well, and I'll sort them out with some tickets.
That's fantastic. Well, what a fun-sounding show, turning science into rock and roll and away from the bland pop music that of science that's normally represented to us.
That's right. And just remember, it's not rocket surgery. Science does rock. And I'm going to put the rock back into rocket science. It'll be great.
It'll be fantastic. Terrific. Ben McKenzie with us and his show Scienceology down at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. You're listening to A Climate Affair here on Planet Rainbow. We're not on Planet Rainbow. We're on Planet...
Planet. That's many light years away, Kate, I can assure you.
Oh, one day we'll find it, the rainbow connection.
We will. The lovers, the dreamers.
And me. Planet Radio, 88 FM. Planet Radio, where all your green dreams come true. Land has been purchased for Nature Biodiversity Corridor in a rambling estate over 1,000 hectares south of Canberra. It's been purchased as an environmental refuge. The Scottsdale property has been bought by the Independent Bush Heritage Fund with assistance from the community, private donors and the federal government. The manager says the property is part of a plan to create a nature biodiversity corridor from the Kosciuszko area to the coast. It has got a very large plateau system of almost 1,000 acres and then drops steeply into the Murrumbidgee River. Then to the east, there's quite a broad, fertile valley floor through which Gundaroo Creek runs. There's a wide range of habitats, ecosystems and vegetation types, which will give it a really rich diversity of native species. In another exciting animal news, Queensland's largest turtle nesting site has had some welcome visitors, with green turtles nesting for the first time in 5 years. The turtle season officially began near Bundaberg in southeast Queensland on Sunday, with the number of turtles only slightly down on last year. But human visitor numbers are up, with almost 26,000 people visiting the conservation park. It's very exciting to see different species nest at the park this season. Apparently, they've had all three species on the beach this year, 310 loggerheads, 9 flatbacks and 4 grains. So it's a bit of a mix and shows that there is diversity in our environment and we haven't destroyed everything, not yet anyway. Wow. what if we could grow rechargeable batteries in vats? In our previous discussion with Ben, we talked about batteries and the problem with toxic elements, but what if we could make them from nature? Well, Dr. Angela Belcher of MIT thinks she may have found a way to do just that. Along with her team, they have established a technique that combines both biomimicry and bioassistance, using viruses to literally produce battery material based on the way the red abalone generates its shell, but much faster. The viruses are not engineered, but are put in an environment they normally would never inhabit. Their reaction to the surrounding materials turns them into a template that grows the desired material. Belcher and her team have also developed other viruses and yeasts that grow a variety of materials for engineering and medicine. It is still just research, but it shows promise, and this kind of engineering will increasingly dominate manufacturing because of its inherent advantages. As Belcher told Discover, an advantage over chemistry is that you have directed evolution on your side. So instead of being limited to a chemical that you can pull off the shelf to build a material, you can involve the biomolecules to be better and better at doing just what you want them to do. We've been talking about a huge range of issues today, and one of the things is, how is it that scientists seem incredibly uncool, and yet we might think that they're actually rock stars? Maybe it's got to do with the education system. So in order to investigate this, look at Finland. According to a major international survey, it has the best education system in the world. This news comes on the heel of several other studies showing that Finland has the highest rate of teen literacy in the world, the highest percentage of regular readers, and the most creatively competitive economy, according to the World Economic Forum. The Finnish education minister says that heavy investments in education are a matter of economic survival for a small, affluent, high-tech-based nation. Finland spends more per elementary, middle, and high school student than any other nation on earth, and ranks second for higher education spending. Schools are local, community-based affairs with extremely low turnover in their teaching staffs and strong expectations of parents. Students in all study all languages, math, and science. In Finland, girls now outperform boys on science tests. In short, the Finns go to great lengths institutionally and culturally to maintain an exceptionally successful education system. So far, so good. Spend a lot of money and you'll do well. But on the other hand, it may be the secret is what they don't do. Finnish students spend less time in class than students in any other industrialized nation. While some kids in the United States begin preschool by the age of 3, Finnish kids don't even enroll until age 6, and their formal schooling begins at age 7. Throughout their schooling, pupils spend the fewest hours in school of any Western country, with longer breaks and holidays. The result of this is a strong emphasis on a family's role in educating kids. Finland scores remarkably high in reading comprehension, which can be attributed largely to an active tradition of reading at home and with family. Clearly, the Finnish system amounts to a successful employment of quality over quantity. Time and money well spent mean kids benefit more from their schooling without having to spend a disproportionate amount of time in the classroom. And free meals for all students mean kids' health and concentration improve. Well, there's maybe a lesson for us. We should be spending a little bit more time relaxing and at home with our families than we should be spending at school, and maybe that should be extended to the amount of hours at work. Certainly, people can be very productive at work if they don't have to spend a lot of hours there. It's amazing how inefficient people can be the longer they spend in a workplace. So if you're finishing work now and it's the end of your day and it's almost the end of your week, I hope that you're looking forward to a very relaxing weekend, and that you have joy in your heart, and that you're having a good one, and it's all looking okay around here. You've been listening to A Climate Affair on Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm your host, Kate Conroy, and you can check out a podcast of this show by going to aclimateaffair.livejournal.com. Till next week, have a great one. We'll see you then.